my name is Terry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
And I'm sober today, and I'm deeply grateful to be sober, deeply grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks, everybody who invited me here. I talked to a number of people, so I kept forgetting who it was. Got to be here with classmate and cousin who are in the program, which makes it kind of a family affair here. We share our experience drinking Hope and what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. That's an easy way for me to start, what it was like. Because I grew up in the middle of a conversation on alcoholism. There was an ongoing conversation in Hawthorne, where I was born and raised, on the disease concept and on alcoholism from around 1943 on. It got started when my own father got in the program. He got in the program because my grandfather got that Post article in 1941 and made a special trip over to our house and gave it to my father and said, "Son, find these people." That's the way my father drank. So my father got in the program and had a slip, and he got back at the program and he worked with others. He carried the bit. My mother said he must have been working with a newcomer because the man he brought home peed on the couch. Got to be a 12-step call. The nearest meeting to our place was about 15 miles in city, in thick city, you know. Not like 50 miles here is. Nothing. He had another slip and he died in withdrawal on his 42nd birthday. And I had three little sisters and an older brother, and I was 6 and a half, and I already knew about the disease thing. I knew what my daddy died of. And my mother had three brothers who were alcoholic. Two of them showed up a lot. So I continued my education with my Uncle Matt and my Uncle Bill. I just thinking, sitting here before the meeting, I was meeting some guys here who I met early in my sobriety, and I started out my time in the program in downtown Los Angeles, and I still live there. Right now, I live on Wilshire Boulevard. You guys escaped, most of you here. It just warms my heart when I meet people that were in Ray Burr's recovery house and at the Royal Palms and sober for years here in the fresh air. This is not where you would have wound up, you know, without this program. Anyway, I was thinking of my uncles because I was meeting guys that look like my uncles. And I can remember when I was a little kid, and they'd show up drunk or drinking, and I knew what they were like sober. I never thought of them as weak or even doing something bad. I realized that the impression was, this wine is really strong stuff. There's something. I just had this feeling about the great authority of alcohol. That if some people you like and respect get into the, if they get in the range, if they get too close, and it gets you, you're got. Because I just watched it. People that I respected, when they were got, they were got. They were going to stick with us until the drunk was over. And that's another thing about the style of alcoholism. Most of my relatives were periodics. They didn't drink, and they were witty and ethical and helpful and good at their work, and everybody liked them. And then they had a drink. And then when they got out of jail, they looked for a new job. I never saw mild drinking, you know. And so I had a funny kind of. It's funny, I never thought of it this way. It was just tonight that this, like the spirit of alcohol, had such authority and its strength. Boy, when you get in the, if you get in the range, man, it's just, and they get you, you're got. Had that since I was a little kid. So there was a lot of talk, and I went to meetings with my Uncle Bill when I was junior high age. Went to the downtown Los Angeles, and I saw his amends list he had, and I thought, this is serious. Look at this. He had the amount of money he was paying off people. I thought, man, it's strict, these people. Got my respect. I went to the seminary to study to be a priest. I had taken the pledge not to drink till I was 21. You know, I kept the pledge. Everybody said, don't worry, nobody keeps the pledge. Have a drink. That's what Catholic kids did at confirmation in the 50s and 60s. And so, you know, when alcoholic families, a lot of us, I think most of us, I bet here, grew up in families with someone alcoholic who was older than us. We tend, I think, to either get in trouble a lot right off the bat or get all A's, you know. Take the high road or the low road. And I took the high road. I was a good kid. Got pretty good marks in school and didn't drink till I was 21. And it's just funny how we all wind up in the same meetings. doesn't matter if you... how well you did. I always share this because it's just so strange that I, in college, the longest paper I wrote was called Alcoholism. I read the big book, several other books, and a bunch of articles on alcoholism and wrote this long paper, went to meetings for research 2 years before I had a drink. And so I was ready to have a drink, if anyone ever was. I could have got a license to drink, you know. I don't know anyone else that got ready, went to that much trouble to get ready for a drink. And if there's a moral to this, if you study hard and learn a lot about alcoholism and say your prayers and be really alert to this whole thing, it won't do you any good. If you drink and have the ism, you know, it didn't slow down my becoming an alcoholic by 10 minutes, you know. I know that I started drinking on my 21st birthday and crossed the invisible line sometime in the early afternoon. Instant obsession. And I didn't get drunk that day because there wasn't enough. You know? I mixed up a batch of Manhattans and everybody else thought they'd have a right to a drink there. And it ran out. And I was depressed about that. I was sad it ran out. But it already happened. My bell was rung that alcohol speaks to me. And alcohol high... It has authority with me. It just says everything's going to be all right. And it says they can't get you now. You know, like, who are they? Who's trying to get you? I don't know, but they can't get me. I'm immune. I'm immune to embarrassment, which is a big deal. I've heard people say that when they drank, they felt bulletproof. And... That's a better metaphor, I guess. But I wasn't worried about bullets. You know? I was worried about criticism. And criticism wasn't going to bother me, I knew, once I had a drink. felt safe. And this special, it, now I, this may be really something should share your experience, you know, but once you're invited to a conference, you get to say anything you want. I have this theory about what alcohol does. I think it affects part of the brain that's right next to the section that registers spiritual awakening. You know, it rings a bell right there, and it gets confusing, and it feels like it's, you know, it's not a spiritual awakening, but it makes you feel like one's coming on. You know, a high is just very compelling. It speaks way down deep. It says, this is very important. You make sure you get another drink. Why? Don't ask me why. Just make sure you get another drink. Because it makes me feel transcendent, like above everything. The little things don't bother you. And that's something like being close to God. You know? I want to embrace the whole world. I was tended to be more of a lover than a fighter. And it's everything seems all right. You know? And you know, what's really cruel about that is that when you're high in alcohol, it's not only not a spiritual awakening, it's the closest thing to a spiritual awakening that's not. In feeling. But boy, is it ever not. You know, it isn't, it should be a little bit like one in reality, but it's like the opposite. And the way I look at it is, when I have two double scotches, I'm never in worse shape to meet people. I'm all ready to say hi, you know, I'm ready to say, but once I have a couple doubles, I am so taken up with the project of Terry getting another drink that I'm all for you. I hope you do all right, but I just don't have any energy to actually care about you. I mean, I have nothing against you. I'm all for you, but I just don't have energy left over to actually care about you. And also, I can't quite listen to you because I'm just too busy with my drinking project and the way I feel. I can't afford to let what you say affect me because I'm just barely keeping it together the way it is. And when I'm involved, when I'm being drawn into a spiritual awakening or a spiritual attitude, a spiritual approach, a genuine spiritual awakening, I think the way you can tell you're in good spiritual health is that you're in good shape to meet other people. That's the thing. It's called love. And I think a person on the way to an AA meeting, just think of that. Someone's on their way to an AA meeting. They're sober. Well, that person is in good spiritual shape as a rule. Because they really don't think they're hot stuff because they're on their way to an AA meeting. I mean, it's come to that. You got to go to an AA meeting. You're pretty sure you're not going to meet anybody interesting because, I mean, they're going to be just like you. You've given up all hope of getting that phone call that's going to change your life because you know it's not going to happen. It's all over for you. Got to go to AA. And so you're not putting any expectations on anybody else there because you know what they're like. And you're finally kind of used to the fact that you're a dingbat alky of the worst kind, who needs to be kept on a short leash for the rest of your life, receiving some spiritual encouragement from your higher power through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and well, here we go. What do we mean? Well, I think a person in that condition is never in better shape than that to meet somebody well. You're going to make good friends. Because we're sober and alert. We've had some arrogance pounded out of us. We have the expectations crushed out of us. And we're actually ready to say hi to somebody. I met people in Alcoholics Anonymous to begin with, and I think the sign of recovery, the sign of, you know, getting a little grip, or God getting a grip on us, is when we notice each other and have our heart touched. And do you ever catch yourself being happy somebody else was sober? You know, they just start telling their story, it's a good thing you're sober. Oh, whatever you do, don't drink. Oh, Lord. And if you actually have a little rise inside where you're happy, you're actually happy somebody's sober, this is a sign that you're being grabbed by God, I think. I know I was talking at a recovery house on a Saturday morning meeting about a year ago, and there was an intense young man up in front. It was a very crowded room. He had steel-rimmed glasses, and he just was staring straight ahead and looking at me, and he was very earnest. And we got done with the meeting, and people were shaking hands and talking, and he waited, and he came up to me and said, "You're a priest. I got to find God. I got to get the spiritual part of this thing. I mean, I can't afford to go out again. I just can't afford it, man. I'll be dead. I got to get it, and I don't have it, and I want to get it." Okay. Well, you're interested, anyway. Whenever anybody talks that way, I always figure that they're already in the middle of a spiritual awakening, because they've already had the big change. They went from not being interested to being really interested. You know, once you're really interested, that's a revolution. That's the right there. And I said, you know, I think you already got some stuff going. And we talked a little bit, and I was trying to maybe get him to see that he'd already had a change starting. And he paused and he says, "Yeah, sometimes in the middle of a meeting, I get glad." He says, That's it. God's getting you. If you catch yourself getting glad, do you ever catch yourself getting glad in a beer bar at 2 in the afternoon? Where you're filled with love for other people in the room. I would love to be of some help. Anyway, I don't know. I kind of got wandering. My own drinking is, I think, unspectacular. I'm a run-of-the-mill alcoholic. If there's anything different about it, I guess it's that it was just so quick that I didn't have any lag time. It was just alcoholic right away, but it wasn't too excessive so much because I didn't have enough money. I didn't have people to drink with. I was a seminarian still, studying with a priesthood, and I was a type that was, when there was booze around, I was, you know, I had a close focus on the task. You know, I knew what I was up to, and I'd get the job done. I would get more to drink than anyone else got, unless you were there. In which case, I might have beat you, too. I'd like to think I could. It was always a big deal. Drinking's a big deal to me. It's a big deal right now. It's the biggest deal of my life, in my world, to be sober. And it was such a big deal, and I knew in my gut that it should, if you're going to do this right, if you're going to learn how to drink right and not get into trouble, you got to be cool. You got to get so that it's not a big deal. So I did my very best to pretend it was not a big deal. I tried to be cool. And I thought I was supposed to do that, you know. You want a drink? All right, why not? I knew you weren't supposed to jump up and down and say, oh boy, go. Don't do that. But it was a big deal. And it was a very embarrassing to me that it was that big of a deal. And I studied this stuff. You know, why should taking ethyl alcohol, which is a poison, eventually, and it's something that begins to put your brain out of commission. You know, it starts with the more recently developed part of the brain, cerebellum up here in the front, where you have your human sensitivity and inhibitions and so forth, and it begins to meltdown starts, you know. And the last thing it gets is the reptilian brain back here in your top of your skull. But it starts putting us out of commission, one layer at a time. And it's an anesthetic, you know, you're going down, folks. And that the temporary feeling of euphoria in between, you know, right at the beginning stage of this, just before you start losing the capacity to know what's happening, I'm gonna smell my birthright for a momentary euphoria from a poison. Are you kidding? That's not the secret of happiness. But while I am figuring out what is, I think I'll have a drink. You know. I don't know about you. I was very embarrassed that I liked drinking. And the way I did. The way it was so important. And no class. No class. And it went on. And my chapter 3 just went boom, boom, boom. I was ordained a priest. You get easier to get booze. And I was just doing the chapter 3 thing. One of my things was... you know, there's something where people will have some way of drinking that they won't do because that's what alcoholics do. Drinking in the morning, you know. If we just don't drink in the morning, then I'm not an alcoholic. Well, I'd have a little chaser at 6:30 minute. That wasn't the thing with me. Other people say, if I just make it to work, that proves I'm not an alcoholic. Well, I live where I work. I couldn't even tell when I was working as a worker. Or not. But I had this thing about buying a bottle after midnight. If you buy a bottle, a big bottle after midnight, you're an alcoholic. You know, social drinkers will go shopping, you know, for a fifth of scotch or a bottle of white port at 1 a.m. You know, it's a sign. So I tried not to buy bottles after midnight as a sign I wasn't an alcoholic. I didn't mind stopping in a bar, but that seemed to be all right. And having attacks of guilt and everything, I was saying my prayers. I remember going to confession one time to this old priest, and he said to me, "Young man, take my advice. Never have another drink again for the rest of your life. I know your type." And that's the last time I went to confession to him. I found a more understanding priest in Burbank. But it just went along quickly. And I was sort of swearing off forever with and without a solemn oath. I quit drinking for almost 6 months one time, and I was very proud of myself. I was depressed, alienated, and full of self-pity, but kind of proud that I made almost 6 months. And towards the end of the 6 months, I thought, this is pretty good, almost 6 months. This is a good quit. If you can quit that long, you've proved you can quit. And if you know you can quit, you might as well start, because... if you have any trouble, you just quit fast. Just start. If that makes any sense to you, you're in the right place. And I did that. And another thing about this, it's funny that I was thinking about that time about being alcoholic. I thought, you're probably alcoholic, or you're a pre-alcoholic, or it was on my mind a lot. And what would get me, and some people never even suspected, you know, until they got on a detox. But I always, just about the time I was ready to admit I was really crazy. Okay, I'm a crazy alcoholic. Lead me away. Where do I go? I would be able to drink and behave myself and get through an evening and maintain my decorum and my poise. And I thought, well, yeah, you can do it. You can look at it. You're all right. Look at the way they're looking at you. They're respecting you. You're doing fine. Come on. Just try a little harder. And when people would say an alcoholic is somebody who's lost control over his drinking, his or her drinking, and I thought, well, why do they have to exaggerate? You know, I just about ready to say I'm alcoholic, and they pull that one. And I say, well, obviously I'm not powerless. I exercise power all the time. I'm constantly not drinking as much as I want to drink. I'm constantly stopping before I want. I'm constantly holding off. I'm constantly spacing out drinks. I'm constantly doing all this stuff. I just don't do it quite enough. So I got about 95% control and 5% not. But if I could just close the gap. Come on, one more push. I had a feeling of closing that gap, and then I would be all right. An image came to mind later that has helped me a lot with that closing the gap. I was thinking, if I had a steering wheel that worked 97% of the time and did not work 3% of the time, and I didn't get to pick the time when it didn't work, you could call that a powerless steering wheel. And that helps me, because that's what I got. I got something that works so often, and it doesn't work, and I don't know when it's going to... You know, they say, you know, or you're... You can't stop when you want. I said, I can always stop when I want to stop. I can always stay stopped when I want to stay stopped. My only trouble is I never know what I'm going to want to do. It's just a big surprise to me what I wind up wanting to do. A little embarrassing, too. Just the want shifts. And that's my experience of powerlessness. And after that 6 months of not drinking at all, I resumed drinking and then quit a lot after that. I quit so often that when someone offered me a drink, I'd say, let me think. Did I quit? And if it was scotch, I'd say, oh, I hope I didn't quit. God, I hope I'm not in the wagon. Then I thought, well, that's my main trouble, is I quit too much. If you quit drinking for life more than 10 times a month, it will affect your self-esteem. And you just drink more than you would have drank if you hadn't made the big dramatic decision, you know. And so I think I better quit quitting and just accept myself as a drinking person and kind of just smooth out, and I think I'll be more relaxed. And that was what I decided to do. And in doing that, I wound up drinking a fifth a day of something. Scotch when I had the money, white port when I didn't have as much. And shopping for liquor is interesting. You know, if you buy a bottle of scotch, you know, 8-year-old scotch, Cuddy Sark, give me that Johnny Walker Red there. Yes, sir. You know, yes, sir. They don't say sir when you get white port. But it's the most bang for the buck that I ever had. It's very efficient kind of thing. And then I was just down the tubes. It was the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization of almost looking normal and being disconnected and in hell, being kind of dead inside. And I started missing things. And here I was, this young skinny priest in South Central Los Angeles, who was being fired after less than 3 years along in my career. I was fired. I lost my assignment. That's our lingo, our euphemism for getting fired. You lose your assignment. Doesn't sound so bad, but if you live where you work and drive a company car, it's a major change. And I was kind of on hold for a little while, and then went to aversion treatment hospital, where you get a nausea drug and warm salt water and something to drink. And you get together with a spirit of good sportsmanship, and that's supposed to keep you sober for the rest of your life. And I went, and I was a wonderful, I'm good at hospitals. I'm accustomed to highly structured living situations. And I went through and threw up on schedule and did everything right. And it, you suffer, and you get very sick, and I thought, that's good. I can suffer. It's going to make up for something. I went through and I just thought, this is, now it's clear. I mean, if you're fired and you go 1,000 miles to an aversion treatment hospital, throw your guts up for 10 days and admit you're an alcoholic, well, you should notice that. And they say, you know, you're an alcoholic. I said, of course I am. You know, the first drink gets you drunk. Let me tell you. I was already over-identified with alcoholism, and that, I had no trouble with the term, because almost all of my interesting relatives were alcoholic. And for me to be alcoholic is fine. I don't mind being alcoholic. It's just that I thought I could follow. My mother used to say, if they had only admit it, then they can do something about it. Well, I'm admitting it, and I was having a hard time doing something about it when I got in the hospital. But I lasted 4 months. I was in a new parish, and I had a revelation obsession. I was just cruising along, not even thinking about booze, and I got this message. It was a Thursday afternoon. In 20 minutes, you're going to have a drink. We'll all be damned. Yeah. 20 minutes, huh? And I had a drink in 20 minutes. And then I was just going. And I had already been invited to dinner by one of the pillars of the parish. I was a new priest there, and they invited me to check over the new guy. And this was a Thursday night. I started drinking wine. And by Sunday afternoon, I wasn't in real good shape. But I showed up for the dinner, and they offered me a drink. And, just a little wine, because I couldn't drink anything else, because I'd throw up right away. From those aversion treatments, and so I just had a little bit more and a little more, and they called dinner. I thought, oh, good, we're having dinner. I won't be drinking during dinner, and my liver will take care of this. I was feeling a little unsteady, and I imagined my liver processing the alcohol, metabolizing it. Remember, when I was in treatment, they had these classes on alcohol, and they had these pictures of an ethyl alcohol molecule. It's a big fat molecule. It has a lot of hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, and then it's unstable, though, and it starts to break down into acetaldehyde and water and sugar. So I thought, it's breaking down, while they passed around the food, and we had roast beef and some red vegetable and mashed potatoes and gravy, and I got it all set there and thought, well, pretty good. We got steady. And the next thing I knew, I woke up down there. I came up slow, hoping nobody would notice. Said, are you all right? Oh, yeah, just a little tired. I really felt angry because it was unfair. Because I never remember going down. I just get all set. And then wake up down there again, you know. And then come up slow and wake up down there. It was It wasn't fair because I should be able to remember. I could stop myself. I could remember going down, but I couldn't remember. And I asked, there was a priest friend of mine, Father Don Kay, who was at the dinner with me. I don't know why he's using his, he's not an alcoholic, Don Cribbs. And he was there at the dinner. We were together in the parish. And it's a number of years after I was in the program. He said, you know, once in a while, I've actually recounted that evening, sharing my experience. You know, sometimes when you talk about something several times, you begin to exaggerate. He says, oh my God. He let me know by his reaction that he didn't think I was exaggerating. He had to suffer through it sober. And so I got to go back to a treatment place again. And over the next 2 years, I went 5 times to the same treatment center and had 5 full treatments. I've had 24 aversion treatments. It's a lot of throwing up. And kept getting drunk. And the 5th time, they asked me never to call them up again. I was demoralizing the other patients and the staff. And the wound up the 6th time in a psych ward in Los Angeles for detox. I got to go to and I'd like to say that while I was in that detox, I think my higher power, the way I interpret the experience, touched me and gave me the grace of feeling my powerlessness over alcohol. Because I was there a few days and I kind of turned the corner, the main detox was over, and I just knew this little voice in me said, you're going to get drunk again. You always do. There's something wrong with you. Whatever it is people need in order to care, that's missing in you. You just can't care steady. Care for a few minutes. But you, there's something missing. You're going to get drunk. No matter what prayer you pray or promise you make or book you read or counselor you talk, it doesn't matter. You're a flake. There's something missing. You're going to get drunk again and you're going to die. And it actually made me relax a little bit. I thought, well, I don't have to get my hopes up anymore. Don't do that, you know. And I went from there to a recovery house in New Jersey just for priests. And as any good recovery house, you go to meetings every day. And I went to 8 meetings a week, at least 2 on Saturday. And I had no idea that that last experience was a good introduction. If you're kind of new here and you don't think this is going to do any good, that's not a bad attitude. You know? If you have a lot of bright ideas, it's harder. You've got to wade through all your bright ideas. You know, it's good to not have any bright ideas left. As I went to meetings, I was so sure that AA would not work for me that I was relaxed at the meetings. I wasn't sitting on the edge of my chair. Will this work? No. I wasn't thinking. But it started to work. Almost from the start, when I got there, I began to, what we call, identify with people. And I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't make a decision to say, okay, I will identify rather than compare. People were yelling that at me, but I didn't understand what they were saying. But I think it's a grace. I think when we're able to listen, we start to listen. It's definitely some work of power greater than me, because I was around a lot of good information, a lot of good people, and nothing touched me. And in AA meeting, something started to touch, and it was, I expected lectures and pep talks, and instead I got these stories, this spiritual jujitsu business, where they kind of just sucker you in. So you look tired, you know. You know, just don't have a drink between now and the next meeting. And when people would say, easy does it, one day at a time, just don't have a drink. On the one hand, I felt a little bit patronized, like, come on, give me something tough. Like it's too easy. And on the other hand, I felt, just the way I felt the authority of alcohol. Alcohol has this, you know, cunning, baffling, powerful, this authority. And when members of Alcoholics Anonymous would say to me, keep coming back. Somehow, I know it's a sign on the wall, you know, but somehow the person saying this had a right to say it. I could tell it was coming from the middle of that person. It was coming out of the depths. And they were telling me something important that they experienced. And there was something in me that said, you know, they know. I think they know here. They almost, and they don't have it under control, but they know something. And I began to just sense it. Hope starts to return. You know, the common denominator of every spiritual awakening is hope. We get a little hope. And I know that it was, and again, this is, now I'm thinking about it later. But early in the time of going to meetings, I sensed two things. And I never thought these could be together. My morale problem that I have as an alcoholic is that I didn't think I'd have a chance to have any kind of a life unless I became psychologically well-adjusted, competent in my work, poised, kind, generous, patient, smart, humble, and very rich, with good hair. In good taste. And I thought, you know, I'm not getting anywhere closer to that. I'm not even headed in that direction. I'm getting worse. And I'm in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm meeting people who don't have good hair, who don't seem to be particularly outstanding in their work, who look pretty emotionally immature in many respects. And have all kinds of problems. They're telling me. They get up and tell you, you know, how goofy they are. But they're sober. They're genuine bad drunks. You know. Bad. I mean, when you got, I just love the people who are really bad. This guy that burned his house down. He burned a house down because he got drunk and dropped a cigarette. And if you burn your house down, you should probably mention that, you know, in your pitch. And he burned the next house down. He burned two houses down. I thought if you burned your second house down, they'd just form a committee and just carry it at Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, and after I burned the second house down, the next 10 years were really bad. I thought, this is my kind of guy. You know? Nothing gets to him. You know, and I would follow him around. I'd see him at a meeting. I wouldn't even talk to him. I'd just go up and overhear him, you know. And he had a light attitude. He was sober, and he had a sense of relief that he got to be sober. And I thought, if a guy like that can get sober and have this thing, maybe there's hope. You know? But to observe people who were very imperfect and pretty goofy, being sober and grateful for their sobriety and kind, you know, and ready to, a generous spirit and ready to help, and knowing you didn't even know how to help. Well, too bad, just give it a try. This moves me, you know, way down deep. This says, you know what, it's possible to live. It's possible to live. And this, and then the thing coming on of, I don't know, is this meeting ended at 8:30? Okay. I'm not going to talk till 9, and just in case you don't cheer too loud, but I just said it so you'll love me. But this thing, the hope starts to return. And, you know, in chapter 5, you know, it says people who don't make it are those who don't seem to be willing to give themselves completely to the simple program. And I never felt, whenever I think of giving myself completely to the program, the way my mind is constructed, that means doing the program perfectly. You know? That means having the results, having a deep spiritual life where I don't have any temptations and I'm just wonderful. And so I don't feel like I'm giving myself completely to this program. But I don't think that's what it means. It means putting the program first. And it means, and when we put the program first, we don't become perfect. What we do is we just kind of move away from putting our hopes in getting security by being popular or having money or becoming excellent. You know, my thing is I want to become excellent. If I become excellent, then they can't criticize me, then I'll be safe and happy. You know, and the person says, no. That's basically, you know, a self-centered deal. We'd like it just to show up, and we'd like it to be willing to be an emotionally immature, frightened, dingbat alky with a dirty mind. Was willing to play ball, you know, just willing to show up and do the next indicated thing. And I think the experience of it is sort of a double, awareness and practice. The practice to me means I go to meetings, hang out with people in AA, and I do basic things that I'm asked to do. Show up and I work on steps, do the thing. And every step I have been consciously worked on, I've always had the feeling I didn't do it very well. I have a feeling, well, you're powerless over alcohol now, but you're hedging on something a little bit. And your faith, you got faith, but you don't have faith to move mountains, you know. And you're surrendering, but you're not really. When I think of really surrendering, I'm thinking of a swan dive off the cliffs of Acapulco, you know. The dramatic gesture. Give all to God. And so I don't think of myself as the swan dive off the cliffs. And so I wonder if I'm really doing it. If you're wondering if you're really doing surrender, you're probably not surrendering right while you're wondering, because you're wondering about yourself. But the surrender, the way I experience surrender is by answering. The minute you say, okay, I'll go to a meeting, you start surrendering. And the minute you say, and when they say, I'd like to make sure you tell all your secrets to somebody. Don't have to tell them to me. Somebody say, okay, I'll make sure I tell every secret and do an inventory. That's surrendering. It's just responding and putting what we're asked first and doing it in a sometimes a half-assed way. Because that's we're much better critics than we are performers. We're good critics. And if you do a step and you don't think you did it very well, that's a million times better than not doing it. I don't think it's possible to do a step and sincerely work on it and go wrong. You know, you're not gonna. It just opens up, and and I guess it's. Home. Somehow I started to feel like I was home in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know there's a big difference between being on the wagon and being sober as a gift from God. And when we're sober a day at a time and have a sense of relief for sober, I think that's grace. And there's something like that that I think is crucial in a program. And that's other people. I'm an introvert. That makes it, we introverts. We're actually a minority, I understand. But when I think of groups of people, I think of a challenge. I think, oh God, a group of people. I'm having a hard enough time with the people I know without a new group. and more people to satisfy and to not get into trouble with, more people to put up with. And that's not, if you're a self-centered, introverted person, that could be your attitude. And then, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Say, okay, remember my mother said, don't have to like him, but you got to love him. Okay, I love you. loving means doing no harm, being all for the person, saying a prayer for them, not getting in their way, being just, and say, okay, I don't have to like this too much, but I got to love you. This won't be fun. and kind of convince myself I kind of love. And then when I would be with you and actually, you know, get through the experience of being with you with being kind of nice, I think pretty good. I think I did all right there. Pretty good of me. Got through the whole meeting without being sarcastic or mean. And what happens as we go along in our recovery is that we are together and we begin to identify enough for someone just to touch you. And when we're in shape enough to identify with somebody and they touch your heart, you might still be irritated with them. You don't even particularly like them. But they touch you. And they think, oh, I'm sure glad you're sober. If they touch you and you say hello and you treat the person decently, you will discover that you know that you are a very privileged person to be able to have some give and take with this person. That you're very lucky. That you're a graced person. That this is neat. That you get to actually have some give and take with another person in sober honesty, and that it kind of cleanses your inside. It sort of says it just brings you alive more. That happens. And it keeps happening. And I'm one of the most negative people I've ever met in my life. I've been going to meetings regularly in Alcoholics Anonymous since before I was sober. My sobriety date's the last pill I snuck in 1971. And I've gone to probably an average of 4 meetings a week since then. And I usually think that I've been to my last good meeting. I never expect too much. I'm always worried about being bored to death in a meeting. So I always pray, God, please give me the willingness to be bored to death. Before the meeting starts. Give me the willingness to be bored to death. Then there's nowhere else but go up from there. And I'm constantly surprised, genuinely surprised, at the fresh meeting we have, the fresh contact, where, you know, we refresh each other's hearts. You just give it a little try to speak from the heart, and sometimes you just can't help speaking from the heart, and sometimes we can't, no matter how hard we try. But try next time. But someone's going to during a meeting. And when that, I experience the grace of God there. I experience a refreshment. And it always brings me back from my self-centered fear, from this grandiose, the big drama of the universe is me. And the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous says, no, that's not the big drama of the universe. That's settled. You know, we've already settled that one. You're a child of God. You're welcome in the universe. That's settled. Let's get on to the next bit of action here. And don't act as if you're still in suspense. It's settled. And I feel myself falling into a sermon here. So if I can stop the sermon and quit 15 minutes early, I figure, well, I'll still be friends with everybody. So thank you very much.